first heard of the idea and saw the lineup of people that were sharing the words of Torah throughout the evening, I was incredibly, incredibly excited by it, and really was looking forward to participating. So excited and so much looking forward to participating that even when my name was added to it, it didn't dissuade me from wanting to come and wanting to be a part of it anyway. It really is it's a chizuk for all of us. There's no substitute for a chevra of people who are excited and passionate about Torah, about learning, about spending Galel Hoshana Rabbah in this way. There are two types of chevra that help us along our journey in life. There's our immediate chevra of people that we hang out with, who we learn with, who we sing with, who we daven with, who get us through every day. But we also need to rely on a larger community, a community that we come from, a community that we're a part of, and sometimes the reminder of the size of that community and how many people share common interests and are really committed to so many of the same things can be one of the greatest chizuks we can find. I know that's true for me personally. Just to be a part and to sit in this sukkah, committed to these things, to focus for a few minutes on Le'el Hoshana Rabbah, is certainly worth the trip and then some. So this is really it. Le'el Hoshana Rabbah, tonight we usher in the culmination of what began, depending on how you count, Rosh Chodesh Elul, certainly what began on Rosh Hashanah. Tomorrow, the Chazan will don his kittel in the morning. The nusach of the tefillah will be reminiscent of Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. The Gemara Din hangs in the balance, and everything climaxes on Hoshana Rabbah. Let me put it as delicately, as politically correct. I don't want to insult anybody, chas v'shalom. If that sentence or two that I just said rang hollow in your mind, if tonight and tomorrow do not necessarily feel like the high point post-Ni'ilah of Yom Kippur, post-Aseres Yimei Tshuva, don't feel like the natural continuation and extension of all that we went through on Yom Menorah, let's just say you're not the only one in the room who feels that way. There are very few people who succeed at making Hoshana Rabbah this natural extension, this climax of Yom Menorah. It's an exceedingly difficult thing to do. If tomorrow morning when that chazan dons that kittel and begins to use the nigunim of Yom Menorah, it seems a little bit of a discordant note and it seems a little bit out of place. Once again, you will not be the only one in the world who feels that way. When the chazan, perhaps, if you're part of a minyan, especially around Vesikin time, takes it to the logical step further, and where he'd actually daven Pesukei Dezimra at the same length of Yom Kippur's Pesukei Dezimra, then we would already be not just thinking it's a discordant note, but we'd be downright frustrated and annoyed. All right, let's not take this too far. We can dress up in a kittel if you want. We can pretend and use the same niggun for Kaddish, but it's really not Yom Kippur tomorrow. And nobody is carrying with them, I shouldn't say nobody, there I go, but very few of us are carrying with us the feelings of Ni'ilah and of fate hanging in the balance and of the Gemar Din that Hoshana Rabbah is supposed to represent. Maybe the only saving grace we have is that the special, and I don't mean to be cynical here, but there's obviously an amazingly powerful atmosphere of Yom Tov in Eretz Yisrael. But in recent years, there's been an added dimension to it that at least we're spared of this year, that you have Jews streaming to the Kotel, the Sikin, mourning Hoshana Rabbah, many of whom having stayed up all night watching a Yankee playoff game. So at least the schedule that the Major League Baseball put together means that except for a few Red Sox fans out there, most people going to the Sikin will have been learning tonight and not making the unbelievably difficult transition from playoff baseball to this final Yom Kippur experience that Hoshana Rabbah is supposed to be. There are two reasons why, I believe, two reasons why we have such a hard time with this. One is what we'll focus on for a minute now, and then at the very end again, and one we'll just mention quickly as an aside before we get to the heart of the matter. Number one, the rhythm of the calendar, no matter if you have the extra advantage of being in Eretz Yisrael for Yom Tov or not, We sometimes have a difficult time making the logical connections that are laid out for us in the way one Yom Tov flows to the next. We could read about it in a Sefer. We could understand on an intellectual level. But there's a drop-off, a natural drop-off after Ne'ilah that we have a very hard time combating. And we're going to come back to that point exactly in just a minute. The second reason why it's difficult is because Hoshana Rabbah, Shmini Atzeres, Simchas Torah, this entire feeling, and really in a lot of ways Sukkot as a whole, is actually a lot more difficult than we sometimes give it credit for. If a regular average Jew were to be asked which day presents the harder challenge, Yom Noram, Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, or Sukkot, Hoshana Rabbah, Shmini Atzeres, which set of days presents the more difficult work for a person to do, so we usually associate those types of challenges and difficulties with the awesome nature of Rosh Hashanah, Aseres Yimei Tshuva, and Yom Kippur. In fact, Simcha and Ahava, experiencing genuine joy in what we're doing, it's often very, very difficult for us to do also. We're not feeling exactly what we're supposed to be feeling, and it's hard to do it on demand. And it's hard to make ourselves do it. To follow instructions is always easier, and Yira on a certain level is also very, very often easier. There's an unbelievable mice I recently saw of a Talmud who was learning. He had the zchus of learning. He was learning with the Meshech Chachma. He had a chavrusa every day, actually, with the Meshech Chachma. And they came to a particular sugya, a particular tosfos, that gave them great difficulty, even for the Meshech Chachma. They were sitting there, and they were having a hard time figuring out the tosfos. So after a few moments of silence, the Meshech Chachma looked up, and he asked his very, very young chavrusa, Talmud in the yeshiva, "So what do we do when there's a difficult sugya, a difficult tosfos?" So the Talmud looked at his Rebbe, looked at the Meshech Chachma. There were no art scrolls, there was nothing like that to answer, no CD-ROMs to look up. The Talmud said, "We daven?" The Meshech Chachma said, "Exactly, we daven." Tom was all happy, he got the right answer. "What are we daven for?" So that was already a much easier question. The Talmud said, "We daven that we should understand the learning that we're doing. Lahavinu laskil, we daven for understanding." The Meshech Chachma said, "That's way too specific. We should daven that we should love Torah, avas Torah." So the Talmud said, "I do love Torah, dedicating my life to Torah, all the time in the yeshiva, everything that I'm doing, I can't love Torah." So the Meshech Chachma said, "It's not true. If we loved Torah enough, we would understand it." And he gave the mashal of a woman who has to run to the grocery store, so she drops her baby off at the neighbor. And when she comes back a few minutes later, she hears from the window already, she hears the baby screaming. So she runs into the house, which, you know, maybe the neighbor did something wrong. The neighbor says, "I'm telling you, I didn't do anything wrong. Didn't drop her, she didn't fall. She's just crying and I can't get her to calm down." And the mother picks her up right away. She instantly calms her down. So the neighbor is a little bit depressed. She's upset. "Well, what did I do wrong? And the mother said, "When you love a child enough, you know exactly what is bothering them and what is difficult." That's the Meshech Chachma. That's what we're missing. If we loved the sugya enough, if we loved learning enough, that's a madrega of Abba that's difficult to come by, that we struggle with very, very often. And perhaps that too is part of the reason why these days lack the meaning that they're supposed to have. I want to learn with you a 3 or 4 line Gemara, very, very relevant to the day. Make a quick methodology observation, leave that as an open-ended question, and share with you a couple of different approaches that perhaps can help us along the way of this Avodah, and like I said at the end, bring it back to the point that we began with. The Gemara in Daf Lamed Zayin Amud Beis asks a very, very simple and straightforward question. Amalei Rav Yirmiya L'Rav Zrika. I know most people don't have the Gemara in front of you, but it's okay. It's very short, and you'll be able to follow with no problem. My tam lo mevarchinon ella al netilas lulav. The mitzvah that we will finish up for the final time, this year at least, tomorrow morning, the mitzvah of dal and minim netilas lulav. So why, in fact, is the bracha that we make al netilas lulav? The Gemara answers, Hoel the gavoa mikulan. Because the lulav is the biggest of all of them. Now, I don't want to spoil anything in anybody's thought process on their own. You should approach this Gemara as you would if I weren't making any editorial comments. That's a very strange answer. The lulav is bigger than the rest of them. And the Gemara, in fact, thinks that it's a strange answer. The Gemara asks, well, if all the lulav has is that it's bigger than all of them, then why don't we just lift up the esrog, make the esrog bigger than the rest of them? And the Gemara, of course, answers, as I'm sure many are familiar with, Amar lei hoel uvimino gavoa mikulan. Since the lulav in its min, the way it grows, whatever else it is, Tosfos famously immediately comments that the Gemara could have or perhaps should have answered b'shi'uro, that its shear is bigger. It is halachically mandated. Forget about anything else, how much you lift, how big a set of aravos you may find. But in its shear, its minimum halachic size, it has to be bigger than the rest of them. Whatever the Gemara means by that, ho'el uvimino gavoa mikulam. It is bigger than the rest of them necessarily so. This is a difficult Gemara. It's very hard to figure out exactly what the Gemara has in mind in answering this. The mistake that most people make in approaching this Gemara, and I think it's symptomatic of mistakes we make in approaching many Gemaras, is in misidentifying the difficulty in the Gemara. And I want to, like I said, mention this so that we can understand it and perhaps apply it to various other sugyas on our own. We're not going to develop it to its final destination or come up with any conclusions necessarily. Obviously, there are comments here in the Rishonim and Acharonim that are relevant to the discussion we're about to have. But it's a prime example of this mistake that we often make, of, like I said, misidentifying exactly where the problem lies in the Gemara. The Gemara has, with an additional little detour in the middle, the Gemara has a fairly straightforward question and a very difficult answer. Why is the bracha on Dalad Minim on the Tilas Lulav? And the Gemara's answer is because the Lulav is very big. If I were to ask anybody in the room, which of those two parts of the Gemara is the more difficult part of the Gemara to understand? So we would all say with near certainty that we understand the question without a problem, and it's the answer that's very, very problematic. The answer that doesn't really make a whole lot of sense. Why does the size of the lulav dictate that this should be the bracha? It's not necessarily so. It is possible that the key to understanding this Gemara is in the fact that because we think we understand the question right away, we gloss over the question. What is the Gemara's question? Please play along at home. What is the Gemara's question? The Gemara asked, why is the bracha, in the exact words of the Gemara, why do we make any bracha other than al netilas lulav? What was the alternative that the Gemara had in mind? What was the other possibility? What did the Gemara think the bracha should have been? What is really bothering the Gemara here? I will suggest to you that there are no fewer than three possibilities of what the Gemara's question was, and all of them are necessary for us to factor in before we can begin to understand or think about what the answer to the question might be. The answer to the question obviously depends on what the question is in the first place, and I'm not positive that when a person reads this Gemara, we instantly understand the question. Obvious, well, maybe it's not obvious at all. The mitzvah Dalad Minim contains four parts. Why are any of them specified in the bracha? The bracha could have just as easily been al netilas Dalad Minim, al netilas Arba Minim. There was no maybe we shouldn't have mentioned any of them. Alternatively, and this is really the same possibility, I guess we could say, maybe we should have mentioned all of them. Al netilas lulav, esrog, hadasim, va'aravos. By the way, there are even more possibilities. Maybe the Lashon HaPasuk should have been factored into consideration, although it isn't always factored in, but maybe it should have been. It's a question to wonder about. Al netilas kapos tamar pri etzader arvinacha. Maybe that was the Gemara's question, but these are all contained in possibility number one, possibility number 1A. Maybe we should have mentioned, made reference to all four of the Dalad Minim. There is another possibility, of course. The Mishnah Berurah brings down, and it's a famous opinion of the Ravid, that if a person takes, it happens more often than you think. In fact, I took a little survey. It happened to at least one of my sons on four of the five. They only missed one day this week where this didn't happen, actually. If you take the Dalad Minim in your hand, and you realize after the fact that you did not take the Dalad Minim in your hand, the Ravid's case is that you realize my Arav is missing. So my sons... they always had their aravos with them. No aravos were missing, but what happened? The esrog, which began upside down, never found its way to right side up. So when they took the Dalad Minim, and they made the bracha, and they did everything, and they did the nanu, the esrog remained upside down the entire time. Maybe that's happened to you once in a while either. There wasn't a netilas Dalad Minim. And you realize it 10 minutes later. You realize it after you put everything away. So the writer is of the opinion, the Mishnah Berurah actually quotes it, that in that situation a person should, in fact, take the Dalet Minim again, take the Dalet Minim only because there's a hiddur to take all four together, and recite the bracha al Netilas Esro, not al Netilas Lulav, to make the bracha on the min that was missing along the way. Although we know that the four mitzvahs are wrapped up into one, based on this Ravid, it's certainly possible that the Gemara's question, in fact, was, why do we need to make a bracha on each aspect of this mitzvah? That was also a possibility of reading the Gemara. What most people assume to be the question of the Gemara, particularly because of that detour the Gemara makes, the continuation of the Gemara, where the Gemara asked, why not lift up the esrog, that this is a fight, that this is a debate, a discussion involving only the lulav and the esrog. Why on earth is the lulav the one that is singled out above the esrog? Now, whether or not that is, again, we have a few different possibilities for what the Gemara's question is and how that impacts on the Gemara's answer. Certainly in the discussion amongst the poskim and discussion amongst the acharonim, that is the question that takes center stage. The Maharil quotes a question that was posed, which may or may not be echoing the Gemara's question, either taking off past the Gemara or wondering about the Gemara's answer. How can it be that there is no bracha for the Dalet Minim that focuses on the esrog? After all, this is the question that the Maharil quotes from the Knesset HaGdolah. After all, the esrog is, listen very carefully, the esrog is the most beloved. These are the words of the Knesset HaGdolah quoted by the Maharil. The esrog is the most beloved. That's a subjective evaluation. If there's anybody here, anywhere else, who likes Hadassim more than our esrog, we can't say that you're wrong. But second of all, we know from Birchas HaNehanin that the principle states that that which comes earlier in the pasuk gets kedima, gets precedence when it comes to the bracha. And we know for a fact in the Dalet Minim that the Torah mentioned first the esrog. So forget about what your personal preference is, whether you like esrogim or you like hadassim, whatever is most beloved to a person. But we know that the Torah itself identifies, and that matters when it comes to brachos, the Torah itself identifies the esrog. How can it be that the esrog does not take precedence in that bracha? So Soloveitchik, it's in the Rishim HaShiurim there, has a very, very short comment recorded by Rav Reichman, a very short comment where he says that this is consistent. The focus on the lulav is consistent with an idea that the Rav developed throughout Dalet Minim, throughout Maseches Sukkah, the idea that the lulav and esrog, very similar to an idea that the Rav developed about Tkiya Shofar as well, that the Dalet Minim, when we take them, what we are doing is expressing tefillah. It's a form of davening. And that the Na'anuim are a form of davening. And because of that, Rav Soloveitchik quoted the pasuk, Az yiradenu kol atzei ya'ar. Then all of the trees of the forest will sing the praise of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And the leader of the pack, when viewed in that way, when the Dalet Minim are viewed, it's Az yiradenu kol atzei ya'ar. So who is the lead singer of the Dalet Minim? The tree of the Dalet Minim certainly is not just random four species. That's what Godol Bimino means. This is the tree that leads the singing. The branches, the fruit, are all part of the beauty of the tree. But the tree that leads the song and leads the tefillah, Az Yiranenu Kol Atzei Ya'ar, this is the lulav. And that's why the lulav is focused on, even at the expense of the esrog. It's interesting that the Maharil makes a very, very important comment. When the Maharil that I mentioned a minute ago quotes that question as to how we can ignore the esrog if it is more beloved to us and comes first in the pasuk, the Maharil says, when it comes to the second question about the pasuk, I have no answer. I'm not sure, says the Maharil, why we suspend the rule of kedima on the pasuk, that whichever thing comes first in the pasuk comes first in the bracha. This I'm not sure about, says the Maharil. But which one is more beloved to us, writes the Maharil, that's not a question at all. Because here, says the Maharil, there's no way you can ever confuse or compare Birchas HaMitzvah to Birchas HaNehanin. If I have a number of different fruits for my consumption in front of me, then it matters very, very much the level of personal hana I am going to get out of that fruit. The bracha that I make, the expression of Hakaras HaTov that I'm about to make to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, is specifically dependent on the feelings I have to the food that I'm going to eating. It has to be something that I feel it matters to me. It has very, very subjective, very much dependent on me and my emotions, my feelings, my taste, my likes and my dislikes. When it comes to Birkas HaMitzvah, nobody asked us, writes the Maharil. Who cares who likes which fruit more? There is no reason for a Birkas HaMitzvah to take on the identity of that which appeals to the performer of the mitzvah the most. That is not a criteria in Birkas HaMitzvah. The Maharil is letting us in. It obviously relates to the question of mitzvah sirchas kavana. But the Maharil is letting us in, of course, on an important secret in Avodas Hashem, and I think it could be connected very, very directly to the point Rav Soloveitchik makes about Azir Ananu Kalat Seya'ar and then Anuim being about Tefillah. There needs to be, the Maharil is in essence saying, there needs to be an acknowledgement that the Dalad Minim are about the Ratzon of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. We need to bring HaKadosh Baruch Hu into this act of Lulav, Esrog, Hadassim, V'aravos. It's not just about a beautiful act, it's not just about fragrance, and this is true about all mitzvahs. There are so many times where the mitzvahs that we perform have every hiddur in the world except for a yachas, except for a connection with the Ribono Shalom. And that's exactly what the Maharil is saying. This idea of which one we like more matters less than this is a expression of commander, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, commandment, a mitzvah, and we who are commanded to do that ratzon and to do that will. And Az Yiraninu, when the Soloveitchik writes that the Dalin Minim are an expression of tefillah, it's another way of saying that we are directing Lulav, Esrog, Hadassah, and Arabos somewhere. They are not random acts in a vacuum. Whether they're beautiful or not beautiful, whether they smell nice or not, is not the most important point. The most important point is that they are directed and focused like a tefillah, as a tefillah, towards HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Rimbursky, this is not in any of his beautiful svarim that he's written. He has a son who lives in Ramat Beit Shemesh, and a year ago on Sukkot, he gave a shiur on exactly this topic. He suggested a slightly different answer to why the lulav is given this precedence over the esrog. We often miss the point, because we're not really looking for it, as to how much of these mitzvos are connected to the agricultural context in which they come from. When one of my children was very small, she must have been 4 or 5 years old, so her younger brother brought home a diorama from school, and in the diorama there were three sections. There was a tree, a little matchbox truck that was driving from the tree, which had oranges on it, and then there was a little supermarket that was selling oranges. And she was staring at it like it was the most unbelievable thing in the world. It didn't seem to be that much of an impressive project from my perspective. And I asked her, what is so interesting about that? And she said to me, as only a four-year-old can, I always wondered how the oranges got to the supermarket. I always wondered, we think of lulav and esrog, they grow in Eichlers, or they grow in... They don't. Lulav and esrog come from the field, and the field is where we need to look for a lot of the insights and answers. That's exactly what Rimbursky suggests. A lulav and an esrog are on opposite ends of the agricultural spectrum. The lulav, when a person thinks about the palm branch, the palm has a very specific connotation to all of us. If you go to Be'er Sheva or Lahavdil, Palm Springs, Palm Beach, any of the other desert resorts there, so you'll see a lot of palm trees. Why is that? The palm tree needs, like the camel in the animal kingdom, the palm tree needs very, very little in order to survive, to flourish, to survive, to grow, to produce its fruits. When they line the boulevards on your way into Ashdod or Be'er Sheva with palm trees, it's not because they're high maintenance. It's not because they're going to take in a ton of water, not because they're going to require a whole lot of work. Basically, you plant a palm tree, and it could be in the middle of the desert, and you make sure it has the most basic, bare necessities, minimal type of maintenance, and sure enough, before you have it, you'll have a beautiful tree. On the exact opposite side of the spectrum, one finds the esrog. The esrog, in the Hebrew word that the farmers would use, is the most mifunak of vegetation, of bushes, of trees. In order to produce a beautiful esrog, there are a myriad of little tiny things that can affect the quality of that fruit. A thorn that's positioned in the wrong way can develop on the esrog this giant blemish that would make all of us discard it, no matter how much of a bargain we were offered for it. Sunlight and shade, water, everything about it, its neighbors in the garden, everything around the esrog affects the esrog. The esrog is an enormous product of its own environment. There is no denying the fact that when the conditions are perfect, the fruit of the esrog that is produced is incredibly beautiful. Suggests Rav Mirsky, throughout the month of Tishrei, throughout our intense avoda of Rosh Hashanah, Aseres Bei Tshuva, Yom Kippur, Sukkot, and then beyond. And in the then beyond is the part that we need to underline. Throughout that avoda, there is a constant tension between the lulav and the esrog, between the optimal conditions conducive for religious growth that are created and exist for any ben Torah, for any ben Aliyah, the Beis Medrash Ne'ilon Yom Kippur, the environment, the yeshiva, and Elul and Aseres Yimei Tshuva, that conspire the perfect storm, the perfect set of circumstances that combine to create this unbelievable fruit, and the need and the knowledge that we have that there is going to be a time and a challenge to produce this type of beauty, to produce this type of bounty in circumstances that are a little bit less ideal, in situations and in environments that are not necessarily as conducive. The entire Yom Tov of Sukkot is geared towards the transition from Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur to everything else and beyond. It's what eases us in to that transition. And it's for that reason that the min that we look at, that we focus on more than the others at that moment, is the lulav, al netilas lulav. Yes, there is an esrog, not just in my hand when I daven in the morning, when I walk through the streets of Yerushalayim. Yes, there is an esrog in my avoda throughout this month. Yes, there has been a beautiful fruit created, but perhaps the most important weapon in my arsenal is not that beautiful esrog, but the lulav that stands by its side. The lulav, which is testimony to the ability for us, for anything, to grow in less than optimal circumstances. The ability of the lulav to thrive, to exist, to grow to tremendous heights, even when things are not perfect. Rav Mirsky suggests a minhag that everyone is familiar with. It spans virtually every sect, society, nation, everywhere in the Jewish people. To begin the davening on Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, and Shacharis with the beautiful chazan's voice saying, HaMelech, where? From his seat. And most of us believe, for good reason, the Meiri has a similar idea about what the Shir HaMalos are. It's a way of building, the same way that the Chazan starts slow and then gets louder. It's a way of building in intensity and leading up to his ascent to the Bima. That's why the Chazan starts in his seat and goes there. Rav Mirsky suggested otherwise. Rav Mirsky said because when the Chazan strides up to the Bima, and there and only there he begins HaMelech, then all of us who are left behind, all of us sitting anywhere else in the Beis Medrash, can be under the mistaken impression that the only place in the universe where one is privileged and actually able to coronate the king is from that spot on the Bima, surrounded by the choir, in the middle of the Beis Medrash, but on the periphery, in the back of the Beis Medrash, then that coronation can never take place. Thus, writes Reversky, before davening even starts, we remember where we are coming from, where our seats are in the shul, because none of us, you could be the greatest chazan in the world, but none of us live on the Bima. None of us spend all of our life in this most perfect environment in the shul. Reversky has the most creative and beautiful approach to what is, in fact, if we think about it, a somewhat difficult line in another Yeshaya, a line that we're all familiar with because not only is it part of a Haftorah that we read throughout the year, but it is also one of the catchphrases that defines this entire period on the calendar. Yeshu Hashem Behimatso, Kira'uhu Biyoso Karov, says the Navi. Yeshu Hashem Behimatso, seek out Hashem where he is to be found, Kira'uhu Biyoso Karov, call out to him when he is close. We know many Mefarshim, many Mefarshim take it as a given that there is no such thing as a synonym and no repetition in Tanakh. And we know that Chazal take it in different directions, applying to different days in the year, but in Pshat in the Pasuk, what does it mean, Dir Shu Hashem Behimatso, Kiru Bioso Karov? What are the two parts of the Pasuk? What does it mean to seek out a Kadosh Baruch Hu where he is found and to call him out where he is close? The Malbim, who is one of the authors of this approach to Tanakh in general, which says that there are no two lines that are nofel echad asheni, no two lines that are essentially saying the exact same thing. The Malbim has an unbelievably beautiful explanation, not Rav Mirsky's, but certainly should be mentioned and something to think about. that there's a difference between Behemoth O and Karov. Behemoth O is HaKadosh Baruch Hu when he is here. Karov is when he is close. Close is not here. Here is not close. They're subtly different. The Malbim gives the mashal of a person who gets into a fight with their most beloved friend. A person who gets into a fight with the person who they love. And the person in anger, the one he is fighting with in anger, storms out of the room. At that moment, if you love the person, writes the Malbim, you call out after them. You don't let that anger fester. You don't allow the little break in the relationship to become much worse. You stop the bleeding as quickly as possible. That's the pshat, says the Malbim. Dirshu Hashem v'himatzo, of course, when everything is good, look and seek out a Kadosh Baruch Hu. Kiruhu bioso karov. But when there starts to be a distance, as inevitably for all of us, there does start to be, when there starts to be a distance, writes the Malbim, call out a Kadosh Baruch Hu at the beginning. Don't wait until the distance is too great. But Rav Mirsky says, and actually the Radak is the source of this idea, he doesn't explain it the same way Rav Mirsky does, but he does have the same notion. Dirshu Hashem v'himatzo, call out Hashem to Hashem when he is close. Once again, when everything is perfect. Kiruhu bioso karov. What is the definition of calling to him when he is close? Karov. Mibchinas, writes the Radak. Mibchinas karov Hashem l'chol karov l'chol asher yikru v'emes. When is HaKadosh Baruch Hu close? Whenever a person cries out to him genuinely. Don't be fooled by Dirshu Hashem b'himatzo. Of course a person must seek out HaKadosh Baruch Hu where he is to be found. We would be crazy to ignore the environment. We would be foolish to make it difficult upon ourselves and to look for God in places where he is not as easily found. But at the end of the day, if we find ourselves in darkness, when we exit the Beis Medrash on Yom Kippur Ne'ilah night and we prepare to enter the rest of the world, remember, Kiruhu bioso karov, karov Hashem l'chol asher yikruhu v'emes. He is not as far as he seems, regardless of the environment and the circumstance. There is an enormous challenge that awaits us, the challenge that we described at the beginning, of maintaining some level of Kedusha, some level of growth, even in a period when we're no longer surrounded by the choir, when we no longer have Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, that emphasis on Tshuva, to elevate, to push us along, to carry us. So how do we sustain anything? How do we make sure that that has relevance to every other aspect of our life, in yeshiva and out? So that is the focus, suggests Rav Mirsky. That challenge we feel right now, that distance and pain we feel right now, with a davening tomorrow morning that's almost like play acting, with a kittel on the chazan, and yigunim that sound familiar, but a little bit of emptiness in the heart that is connected to the fact that we've dropped off already, that we have not been able to sustain. So we get our final dose of chizah when we pick up the lulav esrog tomorrow. Baruch atah Hashem Elokeinu melech haolam, asher kidishanu b'mitzvotav etzivanu al netilas lulav. The lulav, which is testimony to growth and the ability to flourish in every environment, provided karov Hashem l'chol asher yikru v'emes, provided that there is a sincere desire and a sincere cry to God and a hope for connection, the lulav gives us the promise of that success. Chag Sameach.
Here, you're speaking here.
Yeah, I don't really understand why he has like places on the list. I think they're all good.
No, there's some in the Pina.
Really? Yeah. They all say something, don't they? Oh no, one at the very end says Pina.
How's everyone going?
Yeah, I like the question. I don't know the start.
Yeah, I will be.
All right, take it out.